January 30, 1968, North Vietnam launched the Tet Offensive against the United States and South Vietnam. April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. June 5, 1968, Robert F. Kennedy is assassinated in Los Angeles. The country reeled, athletes took a stand at the Summer Olympics in Mexico against racial discrimination, and young Americans protested and engaged in political activism as the Vietnam War wore on. 1968 is a watershed year in American history. In the 30th anniversary edition of his book, 1968 in America, published by Grove Press, Charles Kaiser exactingly examines the key players and events of 1968. Charles Kaiser is the author of the award-winning The Gay Metropolis. He's been a reporter at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and press critic at Newsweek. He's joined today by Hendrik Hertzberg, who wrote the introduction to the 30th anniversary of the book. Hendrik is the editorial director of the Nation Institute and senior editor and staff writer at the New Yorker. And they're both in studio today. So nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
I have to say, I was two in 1968, but I do have a sister who's 10 years older. And we've had this conversation, and she said as a 12-year-old, she just felt like everything, all the good guys were gone. That she felt very frightened in 1968. For you, where were you in 1968?
I was a senior in high school in the Loomis School in Windsor, Connecticut. I was volunteering at the local headquarters for Eugene McCarthy, who was the anti-war candidate before Bobby Kennedy came in. And in the fall, to the horror of my parents, I became a freshman at Columbia University. The horror coming from the fact that during the spring of 1968, of course, Columbia had the most violent anti-war riots of any campus in the country.
My mom was in graduate school at one point there. My father was frightened for her because she looked so young. Why did you decide to release an anniversary edition?
Well, I wrote this book to celebrate the spirit of activism of the 1960s, and I can't imagine another moment when it was more needed than it is right now. And the sad fact about the left in America in my lifetime over the last 50 years is that it's always required life and death issues to get people into the streets en masse. And in our time, when we were teenagers, of course, it was the Vietnam War. And then for me, later on, as a gay man, it was the AIDS epidemic, which once again created mass organizations. And now I hope with all my heart that as a result of the catastrophes of these school shootings, that we are now in another place, yet again, a matter of life and death, which is motivating young people to go into the streets and make the many, many, many fundamental changes that need to be made to our country right now.
Are you heartened by the Parkland students?
I am incredibly heartened and incredibly impressed by these kids. I think they are magnificent.
Hendrik, you write in the introduction, there are these years that we know 1776, 1863, 1945, 2001. Where does 1968 fit in that, and the level of those dates, and the level of importance of those dates, if you think, for Americans?
Oh, I think it's right up there. It's definitely right up there. If you look at just in the 20th century, well, 1941 is a big one for us. 1918 is a big one. And think of this, you know, in 1968, 50 years before that was 1918. Mm. So, you know, we could be sitting in WNYC studios talking about 1918. 1776, 1848 was maybe the closest analog, because that was the year of democratic revolutions all over Europe. Mm-hmm. And some of them succeeded, but more of them failed. And a lot of the refugees, particularly from Germany, came to the United States and became leaders of the progressive political movements in the U.S.
What did it mean to be a leader in 1968?
Well, don't follow leaders. Watch the parking meters. That was the Dylan quote that was a slogan for the crazier part of Students for a Democratic Society. So being a leader was a rather fraught subject. Mm-hmm. Because actually you cannot stop people from wanting to be leaders, and you can't stop them from needing leaders. And of course the two most important leaders of the center left and left in the United States were those two victims of assassination. So that broke something, mm-hmm. and that launched something. And the really some of the really nutty stuff happened in the wake of those assassinations.
And before them, the crucial leader in 1967 is a man named Al Lowenstein,
mm-hmm.
who reads the 1966 midterm elections in which the Republicans gain lots of seats, and he reads them, unlike everybody else, really, as a referendum on Lyndon Johnson. And he, throughout 1967, is just about the only person in America who thinks that Johnson is vulnerable for reelection, and he goes all across the country organizing people, and he begs every single liberal senator, including especially Bobby Kennedy, to run for president in 1968, and every single one of them, believing indeed that Lyndon Johnson is still invulnerable, turns him down, except for Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota, who's a very unusual, iconoclastic guy, kind of a mystic poet, not unlike that other mystic poet from Minnesota, Bob Dylan. And he's the only one who's willing to run for office, probably because he never expects to become president. And I even really, when I interviewed him 20 years later, I pretty much got him to admit that he never really wanted to become president, that he was running in order to change the platform on which Lyndon Johnson would run for reelection. But when he does so well in the New Hampshire primary, he doesn't win, but he does so much better than everybody expected him to do in the New Hampshire primary, that propels Bobby Kennedy into the race at last, and that in turn convinces Lyndon Johnson to withdraw. And there's been a lot of effort by the part of Lyndon Johnson's aides to convince people that really he had decided in 1967 not to run again, and this was always the plan. But I found definitive evidence in Lady Bird Johnson's diary, which was published, that this was not the case, because Lyndon comes to Lady Bird the day that he's giving the State of the Union address in January of 68 and says, "Should I or shouldn't I?" And Lady Bird says, "I don't know. Your daughter Linda wants you to run. Your daughter Lucy doesn't want you to run. I don't know. I've said it all before." And he goes off, and she goes off to Congress, and he has in his pocket a piece of paper saying, "I will not run for re-election." And Lady Bird says when she's sitting in the balcony, she does not know whether or not he's going to withdraw that night or not. And he gives the speech, and he doesn't withdraw. And afterwards, he says to Lady Bird, "Well, I put my hand in the pocket. I couldn't find the piece of paper, so I didn't have to make the decision."
It's a very Lyndon Johnson story.
But it does prove that his mind was not made up until after the New Hampshire primary.
And when he did, make his decision, I remember very well, because I was living in an apartment overlooking Sheridan Square. When he said he would not run, the neighborhood exploded. I mean, I'd never seen literally dancing in the streets before that. It's hard to overestimate what a monumental, global, universe-wide mistake it was. The Vietnam War was on every level, and we're still suffering from it badly today.
And in Waukesha, Wisconsin, Gene McCarthy was giving a speech while Lyndon Johnson was delivering his speech, and the reporters in the back of the room were listening to Lyndon Johnson on their little transistor radios, and when they heard the news, they stormed the stage yelling and screaming, and McCarthy had absolutely no idea what was going on.
There was no Twitter then.
There was no Twitter. There was just transistor radios with earplugs.
Is there something now all these years out that is apocryphal about this time that seemed like it absolutely must be true, but we know it's not now?
I don't know the answer to that. Nothing springs to. What do you think, Greg?
The year has taken on an iconic quality, because a lot of the things that happened, some of them happened in 1969, some of them happened in 1970, but they've all kind of become, just like the American Revolution didn't all happen in 1776.
Right.
But the 68 was the time of the maximum saturation of unbelievable events, one
maximum
after another.
Sensory overload.
Mm. Totally.
Now, were you were a reporter in San Francisco at the time?
That was a little later. That was in 1969. At the time,
No, you were a reporter before in San Francisco.
Before. Yes. Oh, before. That's right. I'm sorry. thank you, Charles.
Glad he's here.
Yeah. No, actually, at the time, I was in the United States Navy. I was a lieutenant junior grade. I was stationed in New York City. I had a very, very cushy, practically no-show job. So I spent all my spare time volunteering for the War Resisters League and for Bobby Kennedy's campaign. Mm-hmm. Bobby's campaign was so well-financed that it had a weekly newspaper in New York, and I worked on his weekly newspaper. So I was a Bobby guy. My girlfriend at the time was a McCarthy gal. And it was really, really rough between the Kennedy types and the McCarthy types. And I felt sorry when Bobby was assassinated. I felt sorry for a lot of my McCarthy mm-hmm. friends, because I think underneath it all, they were denouncing Bobby. He's a grabber. He's too ambitious, etc. Mm-hmm. But they all knew that the time would come when they would be for him. And they were robbed of that. So their grief, in a way, because it didn't have the purity of the grief of Bobby's supporters, was particularly tough.
And the impact on Eugene McCarthy himself was even more dramatic. Basically, McCarthy suffers what really amounts to a nervous breakdown after Bobby Kennedy's assassinated, partly because it had been such an incredibly nasty campaign, and he contributed to that nastiness. But he really stops functioning as an effective political candidate. Another person conceivably could have gathered up the reins and gathered up the Kennedy supporters and made a real challenge to Hubert Humphrey at the convention. But Gene McCarthy is just completely dysfunctional from June until August, so much so that George McGovern, another senator, eventually comes in to try to represent the Kennedy supporters at the convention.
One, why was it such a nasty fight? And two, what was the main difference between the McCarthy and the Kennedy supporters at the time?
It was a nasty fight because Gene McCarthy was a nasty guy, and it went back to 1960 when John Kennedy was nominated and McCarthy had given the speech for Adlai Stevenson at the Democratic National Convention. There was a part of Gene McCarthy who thought he should have been the first Catholic president instead of John Kennedy. And the nastiness among McCarthy supporters was the bitterness over the fact that Kennedy had refused for all of 1967 to come into the race and then only came in to sort of snatch the glory away from McCarthy after McCarthy had had some success in New Hampshire.
And there's an irony there, because at one point McCarthy was asked what he hoped to achieve in his campaign, very early in his campaign, and he said, "Well, if it could get Bobby Kennedy into the race, that would be then I'd have achieved something." But the it was a little bit like the Hillary versus Bernie stuff.
I was hearing that goes
of
it. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a more extreme version of that. But very, very similar. So everybody out there who was either a Bernie bro or a Hillary bot knows what it was like in 1968.
Which is why I wrote, after Hillary Clinton became the candidate, over and over and over again, do not let the left repeat its mistake of 1968 and waste all of its energy fighting among ourselves. We must now focus on getting Hillary Clinton elected and preventing Donald Trump from becoming president. Obviously, I was not very effective.
You were very right.
I'm speaking with Charles Kaiser about his book, 1968 in America, Music, Politics, Chaos, Counterculture, and the Shaping of a Generation, as well as Hendrik Hertzberg, who wrote the introduction. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a quick break. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and I'm back with Charles Kaiser and Hendrik Hertzberg. We're talking about Charles's book, 1968 in America. I want to read a small passage, Charles, that you wrote about the Tet Offensive and LBJ. "The four-week-long Tet Offensive would ignite seven interlocking dramas. They unfolded in Vietnam, in the press, in New Hampshire, in the White House, in the Pentagon, in the minds of Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. On the evening of March 31, all of them fused to form 1968's only genuine catharsis. What do you mean?
Well, we're talking, of course, about Lyndon Johnson's extremely surprising speech that he gave on March 31st, which was, first of all, about instituting a bombing halt of North Vietnam, or at least part of North Vietnam. And it was kept so secret that even his main speechwriter, Harry McPherson, did not know about the peroration. And the peroration was, "I shall not seek, nor will I accept your nomination for president." And as Rick was suggesting earlier in the program, this created the greatest joy among liberal Americans of the whole era. And we had this moment of joy and empowerment, which lasted for exactly 4 days until the first and worst catastrophe of the year, which of course was the assassination of Martin Luther King, which then immediately leads to riots in 130 cities across the country, and so much disorder that at one point the White House begins to worry that they'll run out of enough federal troops to send into cities to quell the riots.
You brought me to the next quote, the next I want to read. It is Chapter 6, The Chimes of Freedom. "In 1968, no other public figure lived with greater strain than Martin Luther King Jr. By the beginning of April, the civil rights leader was at the fulcrum of all the tensions that had been building in America for a decade." What were all those tensions? You want to take it, Rick?
The tensions over the war, the tensions over race, the tensions over class, pretty much everything. The tensions within the civil rights movement. In fact, there's a little bit of a comparison you can make between the Kennedy people and the McCarthy people, as between the King people and the
Stokely kind of Carmichael.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a very similar kind of thing, and in both cases, the assassinated one achieved a sort of sainthood, quite rightly, after his assassination.
But the first thing that happens is that Martin Luther King makes this magnificent speech at Riverside Church attacking the war in Vietnam in the strongest and most appropriate terms imaginable, and his reward for doing that is absolutely brutal attacks from the white liberal establishment in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and everybody else, saying, "How dare this man talk about foreign policy? He doesn't know anything about foreign policy," which was completely inappropriate. So he's being attacked kind of on the right center by the white press, and then he's struggling against the more militant people, the Stokely Carmichaels and so on, who are challenging him on whether or not we can achieve the goals of justice through nonviolence or not. So he's really being challenged by both sides at the same time.
There's a really good HBO film about this, about the last year of King's life, but just fairly recently came out. I don't know if you can get it. There's probably some way you can get it over the, what do you call it? Oh, the internet.
What is it about? What is it about the documentary that was striking to you?
It was the documentary was made up largely of interviews with people who were there. And it was the strain, as Charles said, the strain that King was under was much greater than anyone on the outside saw. And his
Are you kind speaking of, about the FBI?
It was the FBI. It was the other members of the civil rights movement. Oh. It was the young militants, and King gave everything. King gave every bit of physical, moral, and spiritual strength that he had, and he was horrified at the reaction to his bringing an end to the war. But at no point, I think, did he
never took any of it back. No, mm-hmm. Nor did he regret it.
Can you describe for us a little bit about his treatment by the FBI? That they were told to neutralize him. Was that one of the correct phrase?
Yeah, right now the FBI is kind of That's the liberal. that's the agriculture department for liberals. But the FBI was a portion of the FBI was downright evil then because of J. Edgar Hoover, who was immovable and who could blackmail pretty much anyone, pretty much every, he could blackmail the Kennedys, he could blackmail the Roosevelt probably, everyone. And he went after, in the manner of, I suppose, a similar manner to what we see of Putin dealing with his critics, the FBI went after King, among others.
More brutally after King than anyone else. And this is the letter that his wife Coretta opened up, which was an anonymous letter which had been written by the FBI. "Look into your heart. You know you are a complete fraud and a great liability to all Negroes, a dissolute, abnormal, moral imbecile. There is only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You have just 34 days in which to do this." So the FBI is telling Martin Luther King he must kill himself or he will be exposed.
And can you imagine the building that the FBI is in is called the J. Edgar Hoover Building? That's going to go the way of those Confederate memorials.
Yeah. Oh, you believe so, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned this earlier, the riots that happened after and the disturbances and the violence and the pain that happened after Dr. King was assassinated. At Columbia University, it was very alarming to the white middle class when this happened. Why?
Well, it was alarming to the white middle class because Columbia is on the edge of Harlem, and there was always great fear on the part of the Columbia administration that the black students who were demonstrating at Columbia and who were for a while occupying the main classroom building at Hamilton Hall mm-hmm. would get support from ghetto residents nearby. And in fact, that's why the Columbia administration was so careful to negotiate a peaceful exit for the black students when the police came on campus to clear the demonstrators. And the black students were all let out unharmed and peacefully put into paddy wagons, whereas as soon as that part of the clearing operation was over, the lower middle class and middle class New York City white policemen took out all of their resentment on these upper middle class white students and beat the hell out of them as they arrested them.
Kennedy was campaigning when this happened, and his advisors, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, they told him not to give a speech that night?
He was in Indianapolis, and Richard Lugar, who was then the mayor of Indianapolis, said that he had a speech scheduled in the heart of the ghetto of Indianapolis, and Richard Lugar said, "Don't go there. It's too dangerous. I can't guarantee your safety." And Kennedy said, "Absolutely, I'm going to go there." And the crowd had heard that King was shot, but again, this is before Twitter and the internet. Most people in the crowd may have known that he was shot, but did not know that King was dead until Bobby Kennedy uttered those words in an impromptu speech, which many people consider the greatest speech he ever delivered. And it was so moving and so powerful that, unlike another 130 cities across the country, Indianapolis was the only big city, practically, which did not explode in riots and protests over Martin Luther King's death because of Bobby Kennedy's plea for peace.
Let's make on the happier subject. Music. Music is so important at this time. Why?
Well, because we were united on the radio by Bob Dylan and Aretha Franklin and the Supremes and the Beatles, and everyone was listening to the same thing at the same time. And Bob Dylan's early songs especially really gave our generation a moral framework, songs like Blowin' in the Wind and The Times They Are a-Changin', unlike anything ever had before. He looked at what Woody Guthrie had done 30 years earlier. He went to meet Woody Guthrie, who was suffering in a VA hospital, and he took on the mantle of Woody Guthrie and made it 50 times powerful than it had ever been before.
Rick, do you think that Dylan is a cultural figure or a political figure at this time, or both?
Oh, both, definitely both. And he deserved the Nobel Prize for Literature. So I have to say I'm a little disappointed he didn't go in and receive it and make a speech giving credit to the American song tradition.
I agree, and I agree.
Bob, still, wherever you are, Mr. Zimmerman, these gentlemen have spoken.
He's God anyway, though.
I do want to say that my greatest ambition as a reporter and as an author was to interview him, and of course I thought it would be the hardest interview I ever could get, and it turned out to be the easiest interview I could ever get. I figured out who his lawyer was, who is a rock and roll lawyer in Los Angeles, and I told him I was writing about the 60s, and then I said, And I can make a guarantee that I've never made in any other circumstance. I guarantee it will be a favorable interview because he was my hero. And the lawyer said, okay, we'll see, and hung up. And I was listening to Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again, very loud. And 10 minutes later, the phone rang. This is Bob Dylan. What can I do for you?
Wow.
And I said, I'm not ready. I didn't expect you to call 10 minutes later. I'll call, fly out to Los Angeles, but we're not doing this now. And he said, no, I'll be in New York 10 days from now. We'll do it then. And indeed, we did do it then. And it happened on my 35th birthday. And if you don't believe in a higher being after something like that, you never will.
Where do the Beatles fit into all of this?
The Beatles arrive immediately in America after John F. Kennedy's assassination, and they give us a sense of pure joy, which we thought had disappeared forever with those bullets in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And they become, but they're equally important, as Allen Ginsberg pointed out, they were equally important because they provided an example that men could be friends, which after the macho 1950s was not actually something that was obvious to everyone until their example. And, of course, they become peace activists, and they make us believe that all you need is love.
I remember walking down the street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when Rubber Soul came out. You could take a walk anywhere in Cambridge, and that would be your soundtrack because it was coming out of every window. Mm-hmm. Everyone was listening to Rubber Soul.
You know what? You both have mentioned this idea that we used to all have the same experience at the same time because there were three networks,
right,
and there were,
right,
you know, one radio
and
station.
Especially in terms of the music, we were all, everybody was listening to the same music. And never more so, of course, than when Sgt. Pepper's came out, which was really on every radio station and record player in the Western world in June of 1967, everywhere.
Even though the 60s were a time of such tumult and difficulty, people experience it at the same time. Like, the only thing we really all experience at the same time now is the Super Bowl and maybe the Oscars, right?
Right.
Have we lost something as a culture that way? Because we are all so fractured and siloed in our own little worlds. We don't have the same experiences?
Absolutely. We've lost something tremendously important just to citizenship, among other things, that we have so many fewer shared experiences. And frankly, we've lost something not having someone of the stature of Walter Cronkite, who is the CBS News anchor, who is an incredibly important person and honest broker. And there isn't anyone on TV today, I don't think, who could have the impact that Walter Cronkite had immediately after the Tet Offensive when he goes to Vietnam, he does his own investigation, and he comes back on prime time and says, we cannot win this war. The best we can hope for is a stalemate. And that's really the beginning of the moment when Lyndon Johnson gives up on his own presidency because he says, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost the American people.
We could talk for another hour. We have 30 more seconds. I've been speaking with Charles Kaiser about his book, 1968 in America, Music, Politics, Chaos, Counterculture, and the Shaping of a Generation, and Hendrik Hertzberg, who wrote the introduction. Gentlemen, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining me today.